Diversify your university involvement and experience a new culture today.
Isaac UBC is the world's largest student-run organization that specializes in helping you get an internship or a volunteering opportunity abroad.
With thousands of opportunities in over 127 countries and territories, this is truly an international experience.
Apply today at Isaac.ca. That's AIESEC.ca.
Hello, hello. You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, BC, Canada. Sorry for the late start, everyone. I had a late start. You know when you wake up and your alarm goes off and then you say, I'm going to get out of bed, and you start getting out of bed, but then somehow in the process of getting out of bed you fall back asleep. That's what happened. So anyway, I'm here now. Hopefully it's okay. I think we might be able to go a bit over time today. I don't know. We'll see what happens. Anyway, we've got a good show for you. More interviews. Another interview. Special interview that I did a year ago. There's a bit of a funny story attached to it, so stay tuned for that, and stay tuned for great music as always. Again, you are listening to A Face for Radio, a music show with interludes about nothing, and I'm your host, Eric. So might as well just get kicking with some tunes. The first song we've got is a song called Maggots Eat the Moon, appropriately titled for a Thursday morning. It is by a band called Hissing Palace, which is spelled H-I-S-S-I-N-G, Hissing, and then Palace, P-A-L-L-A-S. Actually, I'm wondering now if it's Hissing Palace, but I think Palace. Anyways, the album is Last Offender. They released the side A for this album online on September 29th, so a couple days ago, and it is by a fellow I know, and his friend. They're based in Montreal. The fellow's name is Nick Lanyon, and it's cool. It's sort of glammy, glam rock, a little psychedelic. And after that, we are going to listen to the band Les Chaussettes. So stay tuned for that. All right, let's kick it off with some rock and roll.
Don't be afraid of the ones you love, shy boys. Don't be afraid of the ones you love. Don't be afraid of the ones you love, shy boys. Don't be afraid of the ones you love. Flesh temple orbits the sun, yeah, I think that the summer's around.
I felt the itch in my eyes, girl, but I said you in blue. I bet it's a little paranoid, something new, just like you.
Take you to some schizoid talk instead.
afraid of the ones you love. Shy boy, don't be afraid of the ones you love.
Do you recognize that voice? That singing voice? Maybe familiar to you from the show Femme Concept because it's one of the hosts singing. It's the CITR Student Executive's very own Erica Dolman on vocals, also CITR Sponsorship Coordinator, and whole CITR core band. We have Eleanor Waring on the drums, on the drum kit, keeping things steady in the kitchen, former CITR president, current programming exec, and on the bass, keeping the groove, we have Nellie Stark, also CITR alumnus, former promotions coordinator, and host of the Cat's Pajams. Eleanor and Erica host Femme Concept on Fridays, and Nellie hosts Cat's Pajams on Fridays. And they are a band called the Yolks, as in egg yolks. They just released a set of demos, three demos called Not Your Bay. And this song was called Both No. And I have to admit, I was quite surprised with this album. Very solid songs, great songwriting, good lyrics, nice vocals, instrumentals are solid. Overall, I was just very happy to hear it. And it's great. Great to hear that they're making some good tunes. So there you go. Check them out on Bandcamp. Make sure you put Yolks Bandcamp Vancouver, and then you should be able to find it. Because there's another band called The Yolks from Chicago. Anyways, that's what we just listened to. So if you enjoyed that, check them out. I also just realized listening to it that the voice that it kind of reminds me of is Annie Clark or St. Vincent. So, you know, that's a good person to sound like. And before that, we listened to Les Chaussettes with the song Kate off of their self-titled 7-inch. And we started it all off with Hissing Palace and the song Maggots Eat the Moon off of the album Last Defender. And I saw Les Chaussettes, second band we listened to this weekend. They were very good. They were great, actually. I've listened to the 7-inch a few times, and I like it, but admittedly not my favorite. And I played it again today because of how good they were live. They were so tight. The great energy, great stage presence, great style. And the music was top-notch, so hopefully they have some more stuff coming out in the near future. And I saw them because they opened for Chastity Belt, which is a band that I will be playing a little bit later on in the show. But first, we've got an interview coming up. This is an interview that I did a year ago with a writer named Eric Siblin, a writer/documentarian, former journalist. And it's sort of funny how it came about, because I had never heard of Eric Siblin. But I was in Brazil. I was visiting family. And I was just hanging out, chillaxing on the sofa, more or less. And then my mom comes and tells me that I should do an interview with the so-called Eric Siblin. And I go, why should I do that? I don't know who this person is. I have no real interest in knowing who this person is. But my mom goes, Eric, listen to your mother. And to spare my mom who's listening to this show, I won't do the voice that I usually do for her when imitating her to my friends. Anyways, and I find out soon that the reason that my mom wants me to do this interview is not only for, you know, personal reasons, possible career experience, but in fact, her friend had an interview with him for this Brazilian TV show and had rubbed my mom the wrong way by, you know, my mom said, oh, I can get it started, help out with interview, blah, blah, blah. Something along those lines, and he was a little arrogant about it, and was like, I don't need you. So my mom was like, I don't need you. I'm going to get my son to do an interview with this man, and he's going to do it better than you because you suck, you arrogant person. So it was her way of getting back at him. So I'm caught in the crossfires, mixed two expressions. So I'm caught in the crosshairs, and I don't know what to do. All of a sudden, I have an interview with this guy the next day. Or no, that night. I have an interview with him at 7 p.m. I've never read any of his books. I have no idea who this guy is. So I have a day to prepare for an interview with a guy I have no idea about. And then I have to pitch it to him that I'm going to do for CITR. But at the time, as I said, it was a year ago, I didn't have a show going at the station. I have no real... It's like, maybe I can play this on the Arts Report. So I'm in a weird situation. But... So I spend all the day, the whole day, basically preparing for this interview. And I go meet him at this fancy hotel. My mom comes. Mom's good friend comes to support. Good friend of mine as well. And we go in. Eric Sibelin, I call his room number. He's just out of the shower. He needs a few minutes to get dressed. He comes down. And he's feeling a little odd. He doesn't know what's going on. This is just an interview that was thrown on him by his manager. But things loosen up. We find a room in the hotel, you know, an open lounge area where we can talk. And we get a decent interview out of it. And I promised him that I would play it on the radio. And I think part of it did get played earlier. But now we're going to play the full thing. So get ready. There's a discussion of classical music. There are chats about the name Eric. And that's actually very funny. It starts off with us talking about how we have the same name. And I, as an Eric with a K, am generally very proud of having the name Eric with a K. But I was so nervous, I didn't know what to do, that I start off going, he goes, oh, it's always nice to meet another Eric. And I, even with if it's with a K, and I say, unfortunately. Which is a great shame to all Erics with a K, and I have no idea why I did it. I was so nervous, and he was cool about it. As an Eric with a C, a part of the majority, he can handle that. Anyways, you know, sometimes you live your life, and sometimes you make mistakes. That's what happens. Anyways, we're going to intro the interview with the song Losing What I Had by Lieutenant Frank Dickens, off of his album Sunburned, which was released last weekend. Two weekends ago. I had strep throat and I couldn't go to the... Or no, it was last weekend. I was still recovering from strep throat and I couldn't go to the show. Anyways, Lieutenant Frank Dickens, lead singer of Peace's solo album, Sunburned, is out now on Horses Records. We're going to listen to the song Losing What I Had, and then we're going to listen to an interview with acclaimed Canadian author Eric Sibelin.
I think I'm in trouble.
Hello, Eric Siblin. Is that how you pronounce the name?
Correct. That's right. Yeah. Okay. Always a pleasure to meet another Eric.
It's a pleasure.
Even if it's spelled with a K.
Yes. Unfortunately, or fortunately.
Yeah, it has. The K's have its charms.
They may. From my research, you have a critically acclaimed best-selling novel, The Cello Suites, which came out in 2010. Is that correct?
Came out in 2000. The first edition in Canada was 2009.
2009?
Yeah.
And you have directed the documentary Wordslingers about underground Scrabble competitions?
Well, not underground, but the subculture.
Subculture, correct.
Of competitive Scrabble.
Competitive Scrabble, and co-directed In Search of Sleep, another documentary.
Right.
And your main occupation, however, is journalism.
Well, I've quit journalism. Now my main occupation is writing books.
Okay, so do you have anything on the way?
Yeah, I have a book coming out in March.
Okay.
In Canada, yeah.
What's it about? What's it called?
It's called Adventures in Songland.
Okay.
And it's about a dozen songs that I composed and recorded and stories behind the songs, yeah.
Okay. That's interesting. Yeah. But before we go into that,
by the way, I should just mention that technically it's not The Cello Suites is not a novel because it's a work of nonfiction.
Okay.
What we call creative nonfiction.
Okay.
And so it's it would be best not to call it a novel, which most people associate with fiction.
Okay. I will do that.
Okay.
Correct that. And just for everyone who's listening, we are talking in São Paulo, Brazil. Could you tell the listeners what you're doing here in São Paulo?
I was lucky enough to have my book translated into Brazilian Portuguese by a Brazilian publisher. And the publisher, which has a fairly unpronounceable name to me, it's spelled Irealizacos, but pronounced something like has kindly invited me down to promote the book. So I've participated in a couple of book launches here in Rio de Janeiro and also Rio de Janeiro for our listeners, and São Paulo, and a few events allied with the book. So just signing books and talking about it a little bit and doing some events with local cellists.
Oh, really? With local cellists?
Yeah.
Have you been reading? I saw the video on your website. Is it similar to that, where you talk a little bit about the book and then the cellist plays along?
Yes, exactly. Okay. Yeah. I talk and the cellist plays and
about
back and forth.
You learned to play the cello for this book, right?
Yes.
And your new book, mm-hmm. Is it about the songs? Did you compose them for guitar, which you play as well, or for cello?
For guitar. There's no cello. I mean, there's a couple of songs in which a cellist plays, but they're more pop rock songs. So,
okay, perfect.
That
actually goes into the next question I have here, mm-hmm. for you, which is you worked as the pop music critic for the Montreal Gazette, right?
Mm-hmm.
So could you tell us a little bit about that experience and how you moved from reviewing pop music to writing about Bach's cello suites?
Sure. Well, writing about pop music and rock music was great. I found it a bit exhausting because you're covering every kind of music under the sun except for classical and jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a ton of music out there. And I had to do a batch of CD reviews once a week. Any big acts that came to town, I had to go to the concert and very quickly and frenetically write up a review that same night. I'd tear out of the concert a little bit before it ended and hop into a cab and race back to the newsroom, and in about 45 minutes or so bang out a quick review. I had to do a number of profiles of both local artists and major acts that came to town, and granted telephone interviews, calendar items in terms of what's going on in Montreal music-wise. So it was a really super busy job. I loved it. I loved writing about music. But after a while, I felt that I wanted to go back to the regular section of the newsroom, general news, which is where I started. I just felt that I didn't want to make this my life work.
Mm-hmm.
Much as I loved writing about music. So it was with that frame of mind that I stumbled upon a performance of the Bach cello suites in Toronto, actually. I happened to be in Toronto one night with nothing to do, and I, in a kind of an eeny, meeny, miny, mo sort of way with listings in a newspaper, I ended up at a concert that I knew nothing about, which was a recital of the Bach cello suites performed by an eminent Boston cellist by the name of Lawrence Lesser. And the music blew me away. It just immediately captivated me. I think after listening to so much rock and roll, a lot of overproduced junk, in many cases great stuff, but a lot of not so great stuff that as a rock critic you have to listen to. You listen to every CD that you get in the mail, and in those days a lot of CDs were coming in the mail. And so after overdosing, I think, on rock music, there was something really pure and minimalist and stripped down and refreshing about the Bach cello suite.
Was that the first time you ever heard them?
It was. I mean, I must have heard snippets of it somewhere. They're in the air and movies and even television commercials. But I certainly never heard the music performed live, and I didn't own the music. And it was a real ear opener for me. It was almost zen-like in its simplicity, and I think seeing the music performed was also made it all that more compelling, because a cello looks like an ancient, rudimentary instrument. You know, four strings, a lot of wood, one bow, and yet the music that a great cellist playing this sublime music can conjure up is really pretty pretty mind-blowing. It's really full-sounding, oceanic, and multi-layered, and it presses all kinds of different buttons. I would hear, you know, Jimmy Page wailing away at one point on a Gibson Les Paul electric guitar, and another spot there'd be like a James Bond type of theme, you know, peasant music and courtly 18th century music and all kinds of stuff that really got the cylinders in my imagination moving.
And how did that, so it got all the cylinders in your imagination moving and inspired you to write a book about, if I'm correct, sort of the, I guess, an exploration of the Bach suites, along with the its discovery or rediscovery by Pablo Casals, right?
Yeah.
And could you tell a little bit about the book for the people who don't know it?
Well, there's a lot of the program notes in the concert that I attended, written by the cellist Lawrence Lesser, were pointed to all kinds of drama and mystery and intrigue surrounding the music, and that grabbed me from the beginning. You know, for example, Bach's original manuscript of the music disappeared. We don't know why Bach composed this music, which was pretty radical in the early 1700s. Nobody was in the habit of writing music for solo cello. You know, it was a background instrument. It wasn't meant to be a flashy solo instrument. And yet he did this. We don't know why, we don't know precisely when, we don't know whether the music was even ever performed in his lifetime. There's all kinds of mysteries attached to various parts of the music. Suite number 5 was written for a mysterious Monsieur Schuster. We see that on Bach's manuscript, which was actually, the surviving manuscript for that suite, and that suite only, is the 5th cello suite. There are 6 in total, but transposed for the lute, another instrument altogether. So that I found very intriguing. Why the lute? Why Monsieur Schuster?
Yeah.
Suite number 6 was written for a 5-stringed instrument, maybe not a cello. I wondered what sort of instrument that was.
And
a lot about Bach himself as a human being, much like Shakespeare, much like Shakespeare, is a mystery to us. Then you have the drama of Pablo Casals, who as a boy and in Barcelona at the age of 13, stumbled upon a copy of the cello suites and set about learning this music that was not being performed in concert halls. And was he essentially figured this music out for the first time as a performing cellist, decoded it, and took it to the concert halls of the world about 12 years after he found it, including to Brazil, by the way, in the early years, the very first years of the 20th century. He started performing it in the capitals of the world, including Rio de Janeiro.
Oh, really?
So Casals himself got caught up in the Spanish Civil War, was an energetic anti-fascist, used the music almost as like bullets in his weapon, which was his cello.
Mm-hmm.
And all this taken together made me feel there was a story in the music.
Yeah. And what was it like writing this? You had to, I'm guessing, have to do a lot of research into
yeah.
it. And did you listen to the suites a lot when you were writing it, I suppose, to sort of give you the inspiration to continue working through it?
Yeah, I did listen to the music a lot. To answer your question, it was great writing about it. Sometimes you come across some project that really coincides with your passions, your interests, your curiosities in life. And for me, that was this, because it involved history and politics and music and travel and a little bit of mystery. And
mm-hmm.
so it wasn't just sitting in front of a blank screen and trying to cobble together a story plucked from my imagination. I could go to secondhand CD shops and look for music that was connected to this music or to Bach in some way. I could interview scholars and top cellists and travel a little bit on the trail of both Casals, mostly in Spain, and Bach in Germany,
mm-hmm.
Attend various master classes on cello and the suites, and I could hit the library and read the standard biographies and allied scholarship, go to archive centers, which I did as well, and dig around through letters and program notes and all kinds of primary source material to try to piece together this multi-layered story that was slowly taking shape in my head.
And in this, all this research, I think you found out about Bach getting into a fight with a bassoonist.
Yeah.
Correct? Could you tell me more about that? Because I don't think that seems like
yeah.
something that would happen every day.
Yes. Well, first off, I didn't discover this because, you know, Bach's life,
mm-hmm.
there's only so many facts known about Bach's life, and they're pretty well established. And but for me, it was interesting to learn that Bach had led an event-filled life, that he wasn't the boring character that I think exists in the popular imagination. We all have notions of Beethoven and Mozart that are pretty colorful. Bach, however, kind of slips through our fingers, and if anything, we have the sense of him as having led a kind of dull as a dishwater life. But in fact, things happened to him, and he did stuff that was colorful, including getting into a sword fight with a bassoon player whose playing he didn't approve of. He was also thrown into jail on another occasion. You know, his employer at the time, the Duke of Weimar, objected to Bach's desire to switch jobs. And this was, you know, the early 1700s, very early 1700s, when the area where he was living was almost feudal in terms of its social and political structures. And you couldn't just tell your aristocratic boss, hey, you know, I'm leaving town for another job. I've got a better opportunity elsewhere. No, he was thrown into the slammer and did time in jail. You know, so that's another instance, I think, that Bach's life wasn't as dull as many people imagine it was. He had two wives. His first wife died tragically young. Second wife was a young singer. By all accounts, they were really happy. And all told, Bach had 20 children, if you can believe that, with both his wives. 10 survived to adulthood,
that's a fair
but that
amount.
Was standard fare in the early 18th century. So he met Frederick the Great, sort of this flute-playing, iron-fisted, you know, tyrant of his day, who was, you know, militarizing Prussia, and ultimately that would change the face of Germany and the course of Europe. So, I was happy to learn that Bach was an interesting character after all.
Yeah, the fight instance, this may sound a little facetious, but
yeah,
it made me think of other sort of celebrity feuds between other musicians. And asked me the question, which also relates
like Oasis.
To... Yeah, exactly.
The Gallagher brothers.
Exactly. But the thing that this made me think about was the power that music has to rile people up, be it in a violent manner, but also for you to go on this expedition and write about the book, you know, or write about Bach, sorry, the cello suites.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think that's a good point.
Now, before you head out, I have a couple more questions.
Yeah.
Since we do focus a lot on Canadian music at CITR,
mm-hmm.
and you do have a background in it, what are your thoughts on Canadian music at the moment, varying from classical, I guess, which is sort of where you went with this book, and to the local underground scenes, which is something that CITR really cares about?
Yeah, well, I live in Montreal, where there's a really pretty rich music scene,
mm-hmm.
both at the classical level and also at the alternative indie level. You know, I mean, just one neighborhood of Montreal, Mile End, has just got all sorts of fascinating bands percolating, playing in a variety of bars and recording in a smattering of recording studios in that area. It's really a super dynamic music scene in Montreal, and I assume it's similar in Vancouver.
Yeah.
I think that the interesting thing about music today is that it's although you hear a lot of anguish about the fact that people aren't buying music anymore, I think the other side of that coin is that it's way easier to record high quality music and get it out there today.
Yeah.
So, you know, it does not cost much money to have a home studio these days. I mean, you can do it on, you can even work with GarageBand, which everyone's
mm-hmm.
got on their, you know, even on their iPads these days, and pretty decent quality. You know, you can get a decent microphone connected to your laptop or your iPad, and get a modest amount of other equipment and make really good recordings.
For the
and
song.
Moreover, you can get them out there. You can post them on YouTube. You can, you know, put them on Bandcamp or Reverb Nation,
mm-hmm.
and use the internet to promote yourself as a band.
Yeah, for the songs that you recorded or wrote for
yeah.
this new book.
Yes.
How did you do that? Was it in sort of in studio classic? Sort of Electric Lady Studios deal, or at home on the computer?
Yeah, no, I don't have yet a home studio set up, but I'm that's my next step. But I recorded in a few different places, a basement studio, and a friend of mine did one song on his laptop, and in another case I went into kind of an old-fashioned studio that has a certain reputation in Montreal called Hotel Tatango. It's where Arcade Fire worked on their first album. And, it's got a kind of analog vibe with a lot of vintage gear and stuff.
Yeah.
And so I worked in these different places. And, for various reasons, I think in the future I'm going to just record on a laptop, just for reasons of cost.
Yeah.
And but for the book that I wrote, it was very interesting to go into studios and see how they function
mm-hmm.
in today's day and age and work with different people.
Yeah.
So it was it made for an interesting story. I got different friends and acquaintances, and in some cases hired people to do some session work and flesh out 12 songs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, since you had to delve into the world of classical music, do you think that classical music's glory days are a bit behind, and you know they're sort of getting erased by in our collective memories by the likes of Miley Cyrus and Nickelback, or do you think that those are passing trends and that perhaps a new renaissance is happening for will happen for classical music with the possibility of home recordings and so on, or where do you think its state is? Because it really isn't the preeminent sort of music that we're hearing today.
Classical music, you mean?
Yeah, or? Yeah. I don't think it's on the you know people's minds as much as it may have been earlier.
Right. I think that increasingly people who love music and care about music and take time to get turned on to music and explore music are coming to the realization that music is music and the genres are a bit artificial. And it's, you know, well and fine to say, oh, I only listen to electronic or trip-hop or what have you. But, you know, I think it's a big world out there and there's all kinds of great music. It's not to say that you have to like every genre under the sun, but I think more and more the borders between, say, classical and non-classical are fading and becoming much more gray than they once were. So that you get a lot of rock musicians, whether, for example, it's Johnny Greenwood, the guitarist for Radiohead, who listens to a lot of classical music and I think incorporates it into many Radiohead compositions.
And the soundtracks that he does, I think.
Yeah. Speaking of Radiohead, there's a pianist whose name escapes me who performs Radiohead tunes on piano, just piano. Mm-hmm. So it does kind of piano distillations of Radiohead. And, I think that there's a fair bit of to and fro going on between those worlds, and I think that's going to get more and more substantial as time goes on. You know, classical music is still alive and well. I don't think it's become a soundtrack for museums yet. It's it's very vibrant in many, many ways, and there's new music that's being produced by the likes of, say, John Adams, the California-based recorder who does operas and with neat titles like Nixon in China or Dr. Atomic. As well as instrumental music. And of course, there's the tried and true stuff that continues to fill symphony halls, including Bach and all his colleagues in the Pantheon.
Still inspiring.
So, I think that, I don't think that, I think there's also top 40 music, which is a very different kettle of fish, it's a very different thing, and it has its role too, and there's something to be said for a well-crafted pop song that may not be as rarefied and highbrow and eternal as Bach, but it still captures a moment and becomes a song of a summer that makes listening to music fun, and there's something to be said for that too.
Well put. And I guess final question here is that you have worked in a lot of different mediums.
Yeah.
It seems from journalism to filmmaking to now recording music. What's it like to move from these different worlds, and will you be releasing these songs that you recorded and wrote about in your new book? And I'm going to give you a lot of questions now.
Okay, why don't we start with those two and then you can finish up with the others. First off, yes, I will be releasing the music with the book that's being released in March in Canada by House of Anansi Press, which published the Cello Suites. And the book will direct you to a website that will enable readers to have free downloads of the tunes. So the music will be out there, which is, I think, a cool multimedia aspect to the book. Mm-hmm. And to answer your question about moving among different media, you know, I think that from my point of view, structuring a story, whether it's a newspaper story, a much longer magazine story, a documentary film, or a you know, doorstopper book sort of thing, in some ways you're dealing with the same issues. You know, it's the same mechanics. The difference is mostly how much time you have. And in the case of film and television, the technology is different, and there's a lot of technical issues that that writers are not don't have to occupy themselves with. But to my mind, it's kind of the same process. You know, what's the story? Is it a good story? And how do you shape it? How do you structure it? And how do you bring it to life as best you can? Whether it's a 500-word newspaper story that you've got one day to crank out, or a 5,000-word magazine piece that you've got a month to do, or a book that you've got a few years to write. You're still dealing with the same kind of architectural issues, you know? How do I start it and make it interesting? How do I keep the ball rolling and keep the reader, the listener, the viewer, you know, how do I keep that person interested? How do I keep the ball of the narrative rolling and so that it continues to get interesting and break new ground and keep the attention of the reader, the viewer? And then how do I end it? How do I give a sense of resolution that makes the whole journey worthwhile? How do I, all the way, making sure that you've got your facts correct, that you're not missing anything, and you know, and you're trying to do as honest and as good a job as you possibly can. So for me, those are the fundamentals, and they're not tremendously different from one medium to the next. What's different is more of a personal lifestyle thing. You know, when you're going into a newsroom every day and cranking out a story, that's, you know, you're working with different tools and a different timeline, and when you have the luxury of writing a longer piece, so whether it's a feature story in a newspaper or a magazine piece or a book, it's just not a luxury, I think. You have mm-hmm. more time, and that's fantastic. I think every writer wants more time. It's more pressure at the same time because the stakes are higher.
Yeah.
But it's a fantastic thing if you can nice work if you can get it, as mm-hmm. the song says. And as far as a TV, you know, documentary film, well, again, even though you think, oh well, that's an entirely different animal, it's, you're still structuring a story as a director or a writer, and so the very same issues are at play. There's other issues that you have to keep in mind when you're doing film or television, technical stuff. You know, it's not enough to just get information when you're getting, say, a clip from an interviewee. If a bus rolls by and the sound gets garbled, that's no good. If somebody, you know, the light is not right as far as the camera goes, if a Led Zeppelin song is playing in the background, you're going to have legal problems in terms of clearing that, because it's going to make it into the broadcast. There's a whole host of technical issues, I think, with film and television that a writer with his notepad doesn't have to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
So there are differences. I don't mean to say that it's all the same. It's not. But the other point worth mentioning to younger people too, I think, is that in the current rapidly shifting technological climate with multiple platforms, and it's really useful to be able to work at more than one medium. You know,
yeah.
you know, when I started in newspapers, it seemed like this was a robust industry that was a pillar of democratic government and was not going to change anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
In the last decade or so, we've seen newspapers, you know, have the have just been kicked in the teeth and are hurting really badly. And so, you know, if you can wear several hats as a writer or as a person who works in media, then so much the better. And increasingly, newspapers are asking reporters to go out and make videos or get clipped for radio and you know, internet stuff and blogging and tweeting. I mean, so it is by definition now a very kind of a multi-platform, multimedia universe we're in. So moving from medium to medium is almost obligatory now, I think.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the interview. Will you?
My pleasure.
Do you have any plans coming up? Now that you've finished the novel, and will you be in Vancouver, or the book, sorry, will you be in Vancouver anytime soon?
No, I'll never turn down an opportunity to go to Vancouver, but I don't have any plans. I think I'll probably get busy with promoting the new book in the new year, and
mm-hmm.
maybe I'll find my way to Vancouver then. And in the meantime, I've got another book that I'm working on as well. So.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure talking to you.
It's a pleasure.
The Study and Go Abroad Fair is back on Tuesday, October 6th. Meet face-to-face with top universities from around the world and start planning to travel. Learn about degrees in law, medicine, health sciences, arts, technology, pharmacy, business, hotel management, and much more. Check out our travel zone for volunteering, language programs, adventure travel, and work abroad. For more info, visit studyandgoabroad.com. Free admission.
Tune in every Monday from 4 to 5 p.m. for A Little Bit of Soul with your host, Jade Park. A Little Bit of Soul plays primarily old recordings of jazz, swing, big band, blues, oldies, and Motown.
All right, hello. That was the interview with Eric Sibelin, the author of the book Studio Grace, The Making of a Record, and also The Cello Suites. Studio Grace came out this year. Check it out at your local bookstore. And yeah, we are running a bit over time, but that's okay because Transition State, which is usually on, isn't on today. But stick around. We've got probably 10 more minutes, 15 more minutes left in the show. And then Dunkin' Donuts is on at 12. And I am joined by a good friend of mine because I'd planned to meet her at 11 when the show's supposed to end. But I was late, running late with the show, so she's here. Friend Claire Lingley. Do you want to say hi to the people at home?
Hello.
Come close.
How's it going?
How are you, Claire?
Oh, I'm excellent. You know, first
close,
time.
Close,
sorry,
to, yeah.
First time on radio. Don't have the voice for radio. But
the voice sounds great.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate it.
I listened to my interview, and all I could think of in the first few minutes of it was how horrible I sounded. Because my voice was so whiny at the beginning.
Oh.
And I was just nervous, and I was like, unfortunately, I'm going to how are you, Mr. Sibelin? So don't worry about it.
My voice sounds always, so. No, that's terrible. I'm kidding.
That is terrible, Claire. This is a respectful environment.
God, I'm panicking. I'm on the spot here.
It's okay. To get you off the spot,
thank God.
We're going to listen to some tunes. We've got coming up the song I'm an Outlaw by Kurt Vile off of his brand new album, Believe I'm Going Down. And then the song David Bowie, I Love You Since I Was Six by the Brian Jonestown Massacre. It also applies to me. I've loved you since I was six, David Bowie. And then the song Lydia by Chastity Belt, which is the only song I think on the album that's sung by guitarist Lydia Lund. Off of their album Time to Go Home. Enjoy. All right, that was the song Lydia by Chastity Belt from Walla Walla, Washington. And before that, we listened to the song David Bowie, I Love You, Since I Was Six by the Brian Jonestown Massacre from the song Take It from the album Take It from the Man. And then we kicked it all off with Philadelphia's own Kurt Vile, the song I'm an Outlaw off his album Believe I'm Going Down. Claire, you're from the great state of Pennsylvania, sort of, right?
Pittsburgh specifically, 412.
The 412?
Yep.
And Pittsburgh has quite the rivalry with Philadelphia.
Yeah, I hate Philadelphia. They can suck it. Can I say that?
This is family radio.
Sorry, I take it back. No, Philadelphia stinks.
Thank you. Please, try and be mature. Anyway, but he was good, right? You liked the song.
Yeah, I was into it.
Despite, you were going...
A group to it.
Going beyond, clan rivalries.
I can put them aside for this song.
Thank you.
But only this song.
All right. The last song that we've got to play for you today is the song called Console Me by Siang Venthi, I think is how you pronounce it, off of the compilation album Don't Think I've Forgotten Cambodia's Lost Rock and Roll. And this is the soundtrack of the movie Don't Think I've Forgotten, which is about, it's a documentary about Cambodia's rock and roll scene before the Khmer Rouge regime took over. So apparently they had a thriving, vibrant rock and roll scene, and it goes in with other themes, and this music's related to other things that the show that I'm into, which is how popular North American Anglo-Saxon sounds are understood and reinterpreted in other parts of the world. So, enjoy the song Console Me by Siang Venthi. That's our last tune. Stay tuned for Dunkin's Donuts that starts in half an hour. And you want to say goodbye to the listeners, Claire?
Bye.
All right, thank you for listening to A Face for Radio. Bye.
Bang ơi ơi bon, bon khăng rưỡi.